Welcome to Friday. Welcome to KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. Are you a political partisan and proud of it? President Obama would like to speak with you in a moment, along with indie rocker John Roderick. Hey, John.
Hello.
Former Seattle City Council candidate, too. Also, we have journalist Erica C. Barnett, the C is for crank.com.
Hello.
And the WAH Policy Center's Paul Guppy. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Erica and Paul, do you hate each other?
Not at all.
We are having a lovely conversation in the green room just now.
I'll attest to that.
Well, that's a beginning. This week, President Obama, in his final State of the Union address, said our democracy is threatened by excessive partisanship.
It's one of the few regrets of my presidency that the rancor and suspicion between the parties has gotten worse instead of better. I have no doubt a president with the gifts of Lincoln or Roosevelt might have better bridged the divide. And I guarantee I'll keep trying to be better so long as I hold this office.
And the president said you and I need to learn to have rational, constructive debates. Here he is.
A better politics doesn't mean we have to agree on everything. But democracy does require basic bonds of trust between its citizens. It doesn't work if we think the people who disagree with us are all motivated by malice. It doesn't work if we think that our political opponents are unpatriotic or are trying to weaken America. Democracy grinds to a halt without a willingness to compromise, or when even basic facts are contested, or when we listen only to those who agree with us.
That's President Obama this week at his State of the Union address. We've got one politician here, former Seattle City Council candidate, John Roderick. Were you not partisan enough in the race that you lost?
Well, in Seattle, we're all liberals, but there are two very distinct camps of liberalism here. There's the sort of communitarian liberalism, which seeks consensus, and then there's the sort of radical populist liberalism that acts primarily on principle. And those two groups of liberals despise each other more than any sort of left-right dichotomy, right?
Isn't that the way? The closer you are, then that divide is huge.
Yeah, the communitarian liberals feel like the radicals are just bomb-throwing lunatics, mm-hmm. and the radicals feel like the communitarians are essentially capitalist apologists and, for all intents and purposes, conservatives, although they're liberal in every demonstrable way.
Erica, are you too partisan?
Am I too partisan?
You're a passionate liberal.
I am a passionate liberal, and I am also a Democrat. I don't believe I'm too partisan. What I believe...
Nobody believes they're too partisan.
Of course not. What I think President Obama missed, though, in talking about that divide is that being partisan for a Democrat is very different today than being partisan for a Republican. Mm. I mean, you when you say, let's reach across the aisle, you're saying that people who, you know, believe that God should run the Supreme Court should have a conversation with people who just want to place a few more restrictions on people's ability to expand their arsenals.
So you think that the Republicans, in the case of national politics, this isn't just a he said, she said. Republicans are way more partisan than the Democrats.
Well, it's a false equivalence. It's saying there's two sides that are of equal, you know, of equal weight and have, you know, the same level of reasonableness. And that's not what we're talking about. That's, you know, they're not equal partners in this. The Republicans have shown that they have absolutely no inclination for that kind of conversation.
Paul?
So my take on this is that I was a little surprised to see President Obama talking that way, because if he had governed in the same way that he had talked for the last 7 years, I don't think we would have as much political rancor as we have now.
So, you think President Obama has poisoned the well when it comes to partisanship?
I think he hasn't walked the walk when it comes to working with the other side. And our system is set up where the president is supposed to work with Congress and have compromises. I mean, during Reagan's entire presidency, the House of Representatives was locked by the Democrats, and that wasn't going to change. And yet a lot of good things got done for the country under Reagan's presidency, or at least a lot of bills got passed, whether you agree with them or not. The point point being is that I think Obama started off with tremendous optimism, tremendous support, hope and change. And then the style in which he governed, he got to a point where he basically said to Congress, I'm not working with you anymore. And he started doing executive orders and doing things unilaterally. He even announced, I'm going to do as much as I can without Congress.
So you think before the executive orders, Congress is being reasonable?
Well, Congress is a collective body that's elected by the people of the country. So it's just a political representative.
A very gerrymandered.
Sure, but that's our government. So, right. So a leader's skill, Franklin Roosevelt or Dwight Eisenhower, you take Congress that the people have sent to Washington and you look for compromises. And there are extremists on both sides and both parties.
But there aren't.
Let me finish my point. And so with Congress, what you do is you try to get to a majority. So you can take the majority of the majority party and a minority of the minority and put that together. There's a kind of democracy math that you could work with, and presidents can get things passed, a grand bargain on the budget, immigration reform, more defense spending, the war on terror. He called for a declaration of war. He could probably get that if he worked with Congress on a resolution, but it's about putting together coalitions in the House of Representatives and the Senate in order to get things passed.
But as Erica said, I feel like We're only a few decades into this era where truth is more or less relative, and we're still trying to sort out how you can govern democratically when there are a lot of people that obviously do believe that we should be living in a theocracy or—
But those people don't win elections, okay? So that's why we hold elections.
They are winning elections and they are running for president.
Yeah, but they're not winning, okay? So my point is that a democracy is governed by the people who win. And so, you know, when Republicans have the majority in the House of Representatives, you should work with them. For the theocrats that you're referring to, whoever they are, they're not in office generally. And if they are in office, they can be, if you can get 218 votes in the House of Representatives, it doesn't matter what the other 217 think because they're on the losing side. And that's how you get legislation passed.
My understanding is that there were more executive orders under past presidents than there have been under Obama. Is that incorrect?
It depends on what the executive order is trying to do. If it's sweeping, which is the one on immigration.
I'm talking about numbers.
Well, if you counted up the executive orders, I don't know what there would be. Minor executive orders are issued by presidents all the time, just in the course of daily governing. But making policy by executive order is not a strong foundation on which to govern the country.
It's hard to compare in a lot of ways, administration and generation to generation. I still want to talk about what our listeners can do, what you can do in our lives. Because President Obama didn't just talk about the other side of the aisle. He said, as you heard, that we need the basic bonds of trust between citizens. We can't think political opponents are unpatriotic or trying to weaken America. We need to listen to not just to people who agree with us. Are all of you agreed about the agreeing?
I think that is a legitimate point. I think that people like myself have a tendency to, I guess, watch MSNBC. I don't watch television. Sorry to sound so NPR, but I think that, you know, it's very easy with the internet and with so much, you know, access to the voices that are similar to ours and that validate our point of view to just completely ignore all other points of view.
Seek out other points of view?
Yes, I do.
And really,
do you
listen and try to let that opponent's worldview sink in before you agree or disagree? That's hard.
It depends on how reasonable the opponent is, because there are reasonable conservatives that disagree with me on points of things that I feel very passionately about. And I am very happy to listen to the other side and concede points or concede their point of view when they're being reasonable. Now, if you're talking about people who are just saying, you know, like Jeb Bush the other day, I want to just overturn Roe v. Wade. That's not a reasonable point of view.
That's not even reasonable. Separate from whether you agree or disagree, that's not even a sane thing for him to say.
Yeah.
Why
so,
not? A lot of people disagree with Roe versus Wade.
Well, I don't.
Especially if you read the decision.
I don't.
There are points on which you can disagree with it.
Well, I've read the decision, but I do think that is not a reasonable starting point from which to have a conversation about abortion.
So there's the key as to where we put that reasonable starting line, right?
Well, and that's what I mean by the relativity of truth. I mean, one of the selling points of the internet is that everybody can tailor their cultural input to their own personal tastes, and we're in the very beginning of that process, right? And it's hard to remember that we're sort of in the Model T era of disseminated media, and it's hard to know what the future holds, even 10 or 20 years from now, when we have a new generation of people who have only ever consumed media that they handpicked the sources. So I think we're moving in a direction that's away from a common understanding of what even basic premises are.
Is there anything you do in your own life, John, or that you can recommend that you don't do because you're a hypocrite?
Yeah.
Either way.
We all are.
We all are. Can you, what, any advice? What can we do? I want to just end this on some kind of solution, right? What can we do in our lives, in your opinion, to heal the situation?
I think a lot of it has to do with tone. You know, there's an anonymity to the internet, and we address each other in a tone that's unconstructive. And I feel like each of us has a responsibility to go into our online lives with a basic courtesy. And that goes a long way to furthering a kind of constructive dialogue, even when people disagree.
Be courteous, be constructive.
Yeah, I think, of course, this is why I like working in the world of ideas, is because it's just as the president pointed out, the starting point is listening to what the other person has to say. Also recognizing basic values and worth, that all human persons have worth, that therefore you can't just write somebody off as being completely worthless. Your ideas don't matter. You should listen to...
But don't we really think some ideas are worthless?
Well, the ideas are.
Okay.
So that's my point. So you listen to what someone has to say, and then you agree or disagree and give your reasons why. But the starting point is respecting what someone else has to say. That's why one of my greatest worries is the breakdown of free speech on campus, where people are just simply told, you can't speak. This is a safe zone, and so we're going to be safe from you and your ideas. And that's not really what higher education is about. And if that kind of attitude starts to spread throughout the country, where people in neighborhoods and communities are literally not listening to each other, like, you're not a person, I don't need to listen to you, then we're going to have a lot of trouble.
I agree that demonizing people is one of the worst things that happens on the internet, down to the neighborhood level, the things that I've been covering lately about, you know, neighbors demonizing the homeless. I also think that one powerful and easy thing people can do is seek out views that are not their own and actively do that. You know, even if it causes a sense of annoyance to read a point of view that you disagree with, or to read somebody's, you know, dumb opinion, you know, according to you, I think it's really important to hear those voices and not just live in an echo chamber.
I'd like to point out that that the conservatives now are the ones who are standing up for free speech on college campuses,
right,
which is a very interesting switcheroo from even 20 years ago.
I think good point. And I just think it shows how things have maybe degraded in that area. Erica makes a great point about different viewpoints. You know, I like going on different websites and reading the commentary. And of course, it has to be well-written and well-presented, Huffington Post.
Nothing well-written like internet commentary.
Well, Salon.com or some that I would mention. On the right, there's a great site that I like called The Federalist. It's pretty well-reasoned, pretty interesting, because otherwise I just get impatient. I mean, I don't have time for a lot of schlocky writing. But if it's well-presented, The Nation, for example, or The American Progressive, is that if I want to hear what ideas are from the left, those are the places I go, because there is journalistic skill there. And to me, it's intellectually challenging and entertaining to read those viewpoints and then think through what that author is trying to say.
Paul, we should trade reading lists.
Yeah.
Sure.
Well, maybe we could post our reading lists, and maybe our listeners could
that.
Add to them. So whether that's a Facebook, KOW Public Radio, or on Twitter. Yeah, that's a good spot for it. We're on Twitter, at KOW. We just gave you a little advice. Seek out views, not your own. People are worthwhile, even if their ideas may not be, in your opinion. Keep talking, and use a constructive tone. And we just demonstrated all that at the same time on KOW's Week in Review. Back at reviewing the news in just a moment. KOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. Good to have you along. We have with us Paul Guppy from the Washington Policy Center, Vice President for Research there, at the blog C is for Crank. That's Erica C. Barnett, a local journalist and writer. And John Roderick, singer-songwriter for The Long Winters, host of the podcast Roderick on the Line. And we're breaking down the news and figuring out what to do about it. We still don't know who won the $1.6 billion Powerball lottery. A Tennessee man went on NBC's Today Show today and said he won. He's being kidnapped right about now. It was the biggest jackpot ever. just like Powerball wanted it. They could see that sales were dropping, so they purposely made it harder to win so that the jackpot would keep growing. And why? On NPR's Here and Now, CNN correspondent Maggie Lake said sales were dropping because of lottery fatigue.
Most of us realize that buying a lottery ticket is a losing proposition, right? And that we're not really going to win and maybe a waste of our money. We'd be better off investing it someplace else. So that rational thought seems to be with us. But when they get really big, it goes out the window. I'm sure you were online. I've bought one. I never play the lottery. And we get sort of sucked into that enthusiasm. It becomes a cultural event. We're all talking about it. At work, we're all buying tickets. And it pulls everybody in. So that's why they're looking for those jackpots to be bigger.
So they jacked up the jackpot, and we all got excited again, even though we had gotten sort of over the Powerball thing to some extent. That's good marketing, Paul Guppy. Why didn't it work on you?
Because gambling at those stakes is not fun, I don't think. I mean, you know, nickel-dime poker or $5 blackjack or playing with your friends or going to a casino maybe is entertainment. And so if you lose, you've spent your couple hundred dollars maybe on a great evening of entertainment. Maybe you'll even win and come out ahead. That's even better. So I think that's the healthy approach to gambling. To try to win $1.6 billion is, to me, what are you going to do, buy your own aircraft carrier? I mean, it's ridiculous.
Yes.
I would rather,
yeah, that's up to you.
I would rather play a game where the stakes are $1,000, you know, church bingo or something like that. I think that would be more fun than kind of being manipulated and bilked. And that's what the people who run the lottery were seeing, is that their market share was dropping. I'm a free market economist. They saw market share was dropping. They're not really selling a valuable product that people really want. And so they're changing the promotion of it in order to get people to part with their money. And as the vast majority of these people are just throwing their money away and will get nothing for it, they won't even get the fun of playing a game of chance.
Well, I would dispute the notion that a couple hundred bucks is low stakes, but whereas
compared to a billion,
sure. Whereas a dollar or whatever a lottery ticket costs, I don't know because I don't play the lottery. But for a lot of people, it is a cultural event. I get that, but
yeah, it's a cultural event. And then what they say, a dollar for a dream or $2 or whatever. Right? How is that not fun? You get in your milk and eggs, you get a ticket, and you got a chance.
Now, if you're, I'll just amend real quickly. If you're in a pool with a bunch of friends, then I could see that would be, you devote $50 to the office pool, you all buy into the lottery. That can be a lot of fun.
And you have a 290 million to one chance that your friendships will be ripped apart by envy and greed.
That's the thing. It's a tax on people who can't do math. I think I've said this on this show, this very show before. I mean, it's a terrible, terrible investment, even if it's just an investment of $2. And to your point, Bill, it ruins lives. I mean, if I had that money, I would be thrilled. I would not say no to that money. But, it rips apart your friendships. It makes you instantly, completely notorious.
Then why would you not say no to the money, knowing your life is going to be ruined?
Because she's human.
Because she wants to buy an aircraft carrier.
Yeah, exactly.
Really, though, it's sort of like saying two things at once, isn't it?
Well, it's not. I mean, I'm not saying there's 100% probability that your life will be ruined. But I would want the money because, frankly, I'm not a wealthy person. I was reading the other day that more than half of Americans have less than $1,000 in the bank now. I am certainly one of those people. And it would enable me to do a lot of things that I'd like to do without having to worry about a paycheck.
So then why do you feel confident, not 100%, but you sounded confident that your life would be ruined or my life? Is it that other people's lives would be ruined by
my life,
but not you?
Wouldn't be ruined because I'm smarter than those people.
Well, and that's what everybody thinks,
everybody
right?
Everybody thinks that.
I mean, I think that what people are buying is a week of daydreaming.
Yes. Mm.
And that is a real product. And from a non-economic standpoint, you drive around in your car for a week and imagine what you would do with $1 billion. And rather than driving around just completely with nothing to stake that on, you have a 1 in 290 million chance. And so, I mean, I feel like those daydreams really, really are useful to people. I've asked a lot of friends, like, what would you do if you won the lottery? And really digging down on what people would do, not being satisfied with, like, I'd buy an aircraft carrier, but really saying, like, where would you live? What would happen to your friends? Like, who
and
would
then you, what would happen? And then what would happen?
Yeah, who would you love? Like, if you're not married now, who would you fall in love with that you wouldn't feel like they were falling in love with you for their money or for your money? So I feel like it's in some ways a thought experiment You pay $2 for the opportunity to spend a week reflecting on what matters to you. And then actually, I mean, I have actually considered buying an aircraft carrier if I won a lot. And I don't play the lottery, but it's an imaginative
exercise. Why don't you play the lottery?
Because I think the odds are so. And frankly, I find that daydreaming fairly destructive for me. In the sense that I drive around imagining what I would do with $1 billion, and then I don't have $1,000 in the bank, so all of it, there's a kind of draining out, a disappointment that has nothing to do with losing, but everything to do with realizing that I've been living in a fantasy world for a week. But I feel like
Is useful or it's destructive?
I feel like you can hold both those ideas simultaneously. It is an exercise in dreaming, but it's also, it can be sad.
So I think what you're describing is a matter of degree. So people who sort of reasonably buy a ticket once in a while or join the office pool, that's moderate. What I get more concerned about is its impact as social policy,
right?
That the lotteries are run by the government and, you know, they're promoted to citizens to part with their money. And it tends to be low income people who disproportionately participate more. And if someone is doing it habitually day after day, week after week, and they're low income to begin with, I'm not sure that that's a good role for the government to be in, to create a program whose purpose is to get people to contribute money with very little chance of winning.
Who think it's their retirement plan.
So if each of you could wave your wand, you make the lottery go away? Sounds like yes, Paul. Government lottery.
I would get the government out of it. Maybe I could see a highly regulated private entertainment industry like Las Vegas or something. But I've never liked government sponsorship of gambling.
Okay.
I would get the government out of it as well for some of the same reasons, but I would also change the tax structure of our entire, you know, society or state or whatever, so that we didn't need lotteries, because that is a ridiculous way to raise money for the government.
Yeah. Yeah.
We need that money, but we need to get it a different way.
Yeah, I agree. And I feel like it's emblematic of an inflation in what we consider wealth. I mean, when I was a young person, if you had $1 million, that was, you were a millionaire.
Yeah.
And now we have this idea that if you don't have $1 billion, you're not really wealthy. And that's...
Thank you. I don't buy tickets because I want to remember that, relatively speaking, I am rich. That's a personal thing, you know, relatively speaking compared to the world. But you guys are making me want to buy tickets just so I can prove that I could still be happy. This is KOW's Week in Review. So we got a couple, three votes for the lottery to go away. What about tipping? That and more coming up. Welcome back to KOW's Week in Review with John Roderick and Paul Guppy and Erica C. Barnett. I'm Bill Radke. It's time for the sound of the day. Anyone name that sound?
I didn't hear it.
Oh, the sound of a tunneling machine not operating.
Bingo. Bertha, we want to hear it again? Good job, Paul. You win that one. This week, Governor Jay Inslee ordered the tunneling to stop until we know why a big sinkhole opened up above Bertha, 35 feet by 20 feet by 15 feet deep. KOW reporter Joshua McNichols, remind us how a sinkhole works.
Think of the last time you made a sandcastle. Sometimes when you're digging a tunnel through the castle, parts come crashing down. That's kind of how sinkholes form. Bertha is digging through a mixture of sand and clay. Sometimes the vibrations will cause pockets of sand to shake loose and just slide into Bertha's cutter head, where it's carried away. That leaves a hole on the surface. The trick is to catch sinkholes early enough so that you can quickly inject grout or concrete into the ground and stop the ground from collapsing. The contractor was supposedly carefully monitoring the ground for that kind of movement.
Supposedly?
There's so much supposedly about Bertha.
Yes, indeed.
Look, they were really focused on making that machine move forward. They couldn't bother to look at what was going on.
That's essentially what the group building the tunnel, Seattle Tunnel Partners, told the Seattle Times. The tunnel team has focused lately on Bertha's speed, force, efficiency, and temperature, and didn't perform continuous soil checks. Where to begin? Former city council candidate John Roderick, what's the lesson here?
I feel like the tunnel from the very beginning was an archaic technology. I mean, we're moving into a realm where we're going to have self-piloting cars, and in the very near future, at which point big freeways are going to be essentially obsolete. We're building an infrastructure now.
Why? What are the self-driving cars going to drive through?
I mean, self-driving cars are going to use our roads much more efficiently. And a big tunnel like this to get from one end of the city to the other for, you know, for people driving their semi-trucks or whatever, it's the equivalent of building an elevated railway just as buses come online, right? It's a technology of the 20th century, and city government needs to be thinking about the technology of the 21st century, right?
What's your alternative to if you could have?
The alternative
is something different.
No tunnel, right? San Francisco is a perfect model. After the earthquake in 89, the Embarcadero Freeway, which also ran along the waterfront and was perceived to be absolutely necessary for moving traffic through San Francisco, that freeway collapsed and they did not rebuild it. And what happened was a tremendous revitalization of their waterfront, and people somehow make it through San Francisco. I mean, there is no crosstown freeway, but people use surface streets, and okay. San Francisco thrives.
So you think in the near future, surface streets will be able to handle enough of that traffic?
Absolutely.
Erica?
Well, I agree. I don't think that self-driving cars are in our imminent future, and I think there are a lot of issues.
They're coming online in the next year.
Yeah, I mean,
self-driving scooters in your case.
Oh, I don't think they have that technology yet, sadly, but I'll be able to zip in between those tiny cars. But, you know, I mean, I think the larger story here is that the tunnel partners are desperate to show some progress and show some good news. And they're doing things. They're cutting, you know, not just corners. They're cutting, like, you know, entire, you know, just bodies of work out of their equation. They're not doing basic things like checking for whether there's going to be a giant sinkhole. And if that's the case now, as we're above the surface and still able to catch these things quickly and get to them easily, I really worry for what's going to happen when they go through downtown and they're not able to access the tunnel digging machine.
Don't we assume they'll do things differently when they're diving underneath the viaduct than what they'll do when
anything.
Supposedly.
So there's another supposedly.
So when the New York City subway system was being built, it was guys with shovels underground and a big, you know, steel shelter for them to work in. And sometimes I wonder whether the low-tech approach might not have been better in this case, not actually hand shovels, but, you know, equipment working underground, cut and cover, or whatever is used in the mining industry when they tunnel underground, instead of going for this enormous machine. And so that, as a policy analyst, that makes me question what were the decisions that were made, I guess, by Governor Gregoire at the beginning of starting this project. And I think the lesson is a healthy skepticism of the promises of massive government projects that are billions and billions of dollars. And once you're into them, you're stuck. So there are not only is the tunneling machine stuck, but I mean, the taxpayers in general are stuck. This is a state highway. So everybody in the state is on the hook at some level for paying for it. And it just next time one of these big projects and promises comes along, I think it would be a good idea for people to say, you know, no thanks. Or
Erica, you agree the lesson is don't trust big government projects?
No, I don't think that's the lesson. I think the lesson is that we should have listened to the people when they said they didn't want a tunnel. And, you know, the reason that we didn't do a cut and cover tunnel, like Paul is suggesting, is because the state wanted to make the waterfront accessible. Now, the way they did it was by building a four-lane tunnel that bypasses downtown and a giant surface street on the waterfront, which is not going to be particularly friendly to people trying to get to the actual waterfront,
like,
from downtown.
Like a boulevard.
Yeah, they went with a compromise solution, quote unquote, and that's ending up costing us billions of dollars. And, you know, I don't know if they're going to finish the thing. I mean, I'm starting to.
Is anybody? No one's seriously saying pull the plug, right?
Maybe it'll be underground Seattle of the future. Yeah, there'll be tours down there of the unfinished tunnel.
I think they
will try to finish.
You'd pull the plug. Talk about government waste. I mean, you want to kiss off that much money?
But you get into, you know, the sunk cost fallacy, which is you know, I've spent all this money already, and we're 2 years behind schedule. Like, how embarrassing.
You would start again and do what?
Waste.
You would do the same, just a surface street?
I would do just the surface street.
Okay.
Absolutely.
It is interesting because there are always lessons from the private sector where competition is unrelentingly fierce. And it's impressive how big corporations, if you look through history, will ruthlessly cut a program that is just simply not working, no matter how much they have sunk into it. I mean, the Ford company canceled the Edsel, for example, after years of work in the 1950s.
But they
wrote it all off.
It's a state highway. Wasn't the knock that you just can't get enough cargo and people through on a surface street? I know John's more optimistic about the
So I'm just trying to provide perspective. Yeah. So I'm not recommending that they cancel this project. As a public project and a state highway, I think the state is committed, and no matter what it costs, they're going to finish it. What I'm saying is that I guess the lesson for the future, again, is other big companies have said when faced with competition, they're like, we don't care how much we've invested, we have to get out. And for public projects, I think you have to the public has to, and I like votes on these projects and to hear from the people, because that gives you that wisdom as to whether you should go down this road in the first place. And that's the lesson I think we have to learn from this.
And I think with Seattle Tunnel Partners, I mean, they have a situation where they have a design build contract, which means they're, you know, supposedly, we'll see how the lawsuits all
come out. There's that word supposedly.
There it is.
Well, I think that is very supposedly.
Because it'll be in the courts.
It's going to be in the courts forever. But they are supposedly on the hook for any cost overruns. So there is a big incentive for them to just say, we can't do this. But on the other hand, I mean, of course, then they're subject to all kinds of lawsuits. But there is, I agree that there's tremendous pressure to cut corners and save money and move forward as fast as they can, despite the consequences.
We're going to move this show forward as fast as we can and do it under budget and on time. There's a couple of votes for a surface option and even pulling the plug, and a vote for don't pull the plug, but don't trust big government projects.
Just be careful in the future.
Yeah.
And I feel like the one possible good outcome is that we get under there and we discover that there's a like a mine of Moria full of dwarves that are mining gold, and then it'll pay for the whole project.
Right. So let's not write it off.
Sure.
Because of irrational fears.
There might be the treasure of the Sierra Madre over there, and we just didn't know about it.
Why are you not on the Seattle City Council?
Well, you know, the city didn't have a vision for me.
Supposedly.
Yeah.
John Roderick and Erica C. Barnett and Paul Guppy and you. We're going to talk tipping and David Bowie when we come back. KUOW's Week in Review, right back at it, as I promised, under budget and on time. I'm Bill Radke. Tipping is beginning to go away in Seattle. With the mandated minimum wage rising, restaurant impresario Tom Douglas told us he is replacing tipping with a 20% service charge at three of his restaurants starting next month. I asked him yesterday on this show, what if I'm a career waiter? I take pride in giving great service and being tipped very well for it.
Go ask somebody at Nordstrom who's selling shoes or selling a dress. What do they do every day? They don't make a tip. They make a commission. And they get excited. The more they sell, the more commission they make. And the better they treat their customers, the more the customers come back and buy another dress. This is exactly the same thing. There's no less incentive to be good at what you do. And in a funny way, it's even more noble, I think, because they're not at the whim of everybody who happens to sit down in the section, whether that person is a seasoned, traveled, veteran dining person or somebody who goes out to kind of throw their money around and be the boss.
Now, restaurant owners are listening to us right now, and they want to know how their customers would react to, a mandatory service charge and the end of the tip line on your bill. Erica, what do you want to tell them?
I am thrilled with that idea because I don't want servers feeling as though they have to pander to me or, you know, be obsequious or, you know, just behave in a way that they aren't comfortable with so that I'll give them a bigger tip. And I also don't want, as a customer and just as a citizen, I don't want people's wages and how much money they take home to, you know, themselves or their family every week dependent on me and other people like me who may be having a bad day or may just not like the way they look. I think that.
But on the flip side, don't you make great tips if they think you're having a great relationship and a great time?
I think that's what the 20% service charge is for. And I think Tom Douglas also said that he'll be paying $15 and more to some of his servers. I hope that that is true. I don't want to see servers make less money, but I also don't want it to be a competitive environment where, you know, for example, you get sexually harassed as a waitress, which happens all the time. There was a report that said that 90% of waitresses said they'd been sexually harassed on the job by customers last year. And, you know, I don't want...
Not me. I haven't been doing that.
I don't want servers... Well, by someone. I don't want servers to feel like, you know, they have to... they have to dress more provocatively, or they have to put up with, you know, customers who ask for their number, which I've certainly have seen happen. So I think it just creates a much more reasonable workplace, and it brings servers and restaurants in line with the rest of the economy, like Nordstrom.
Paul, agreed? goodbye tipping and the pandering that goes with it?
Well, again, I tend to look at things from a policy point of view. So what Tom Douglas, who's a businessman, is he's adapting to conditions that have changed in the city. So a law was passed. I think from an economic point of view, of course, I've said this a lot about the minimum wage, is that when the wage is artificially increased, then it reduces restaurant jobs. And I read a report that Seattle lost 700 restaurant jobs last year, even though the state as a whole increased. So the larger problem to me is less work opportunity. For those who are employed, what Erica is saying is exactly correct. And what Tom Douglas said is that if you have a set wage or a commission, then you're not dependent on what the customer does. I think the outcome of that is a change in the culture of service and tipping. So when people's expectations change, you know, I don't tip my dentist, okay, I don't tip the person at Nordstrom's, and that may come over to the world of restaurants, where now I'm not expected to tip the restaurant server either. And it's more a straight up, you know, I order the meal, they hand me the bill. The larger economic impact is that as the price of dining out goes up, people will do less of it. And so then the market as a whole will get smaller.
But wait, how does the price of dining go up? I mean, I guess we're just assuming that nobody I always tip at least 20%, but I've worked in service.
That's voluntary. So what I'm trying to say is that the person who's selling the restaurant experience has to cover all of his costs. That's what Tom Douglas is dealing with. Just the math of the increase in the minimum wage. He has come up with a business model to do that. The result is going to be higher prices. Now, for a lot of people who go to restaurants, they don't care. They just get out their credit card and they want to eat at a Tom Douglas restaurant. They don't care if it costs $160.
So you'd rather have no, as you say, artificially raised minimum wage and keep tipping? A voluntary way to
sure
support.
If that's what people want to do. So my point about, this is always my point about the minimum wage, which is a separate debate.
That's not a matter of what we want to do. We just do it because we're supposed to.
Is that the minimum wage is a price control. So it has automatically taken away the voluntary relationship between providers and customers.
Well, I would say tipping is not really a voluntary thing. I think that most people go to a restaurant. I mean, if you don't tip, then you are some kind of monster.
Sure.
It's that strange kind of voluntary, involuntary nexus.
It depends.
It is voluntary.
It's sort of,
technically.
It's sort of culturally.
Mandatory.
That's what Tom Douglas was saying. I mean, my sister used to work at Ivers on the waterfront, and that was a popular destination for people that go out to dinner 2 times a year. And those people don't know the protocol of 20%, or a lot of them don't. So there were lots of situations where, you know, the servers there would either have to take the pennies that were thrown on the table, or a lot of times they would be fed up and they would sort of lecture their customers, like, you know that you're in the big city now, and it's 20% tip here is what we expect.
But that goes back to what President Obama was saying about listening to other people and getting along and communicating, which again is a voluntary interaction.
But it's a voluntary interaction that's going to determine whether a waitress is able to pay her light bill that month.
When people work, they want to earn their salary. I don't think that a law which sets a price control, which would mess up anybody else's job, any other part of the economy where the government came in and set what salaries were, which is what the Soviet Union did, would completely distort the economy. The only reason it's tolerable is because only low-income and unemployed people are affected. 95 or 97% of people don't make the minimum wage and they're not affected. But at the bottom end of the labor scale, they're the ones who were impacted.
I want to ask how you feel about the idea of tipping going away. So back to my questions, what information, because this is your chance to tell restaurateurs you want tipping to go away. Erica's on record, go away tipping. John?
I feel like there's going to be an interregnum here where a generation of people have been taught to tip, and they're going to be even sort of reluctant to give that up. I know I will.
Yeah, me too.
That's what Tom Douglas said.
Yeah.
It's going to be a generational thing. It's going to take a while.
They'll put 20% service charge on there, and then we'll still feel like tipping is a social gesture.
So this is the time to get into being a waiter right now while people are still paying 20% and tipping above because that's what they're used to.
I went to actually Ivar's and did an interview of a city council candidate there recently, and I was really, as someone who grew up, you know, tipping, and I can calculate tips in my head, no problem, and all of that. Yeah, I know. Paul's giving me a look like that's not hard math, Erica. But I've found that it is for some people. But because of that, you know, I saw the new prices and I was like, whoa, because Ivar's went to no tipping a while ago. And so so I was a little shocked. But then I realized, oh, that's with the service charge. And I was kind of relieved. Like, OK, that decision has been taken out of my hands.
But you could still tip. I mean, you never can get off that hook because you know that you could add more if you wanted to. But you feel... If it's done,
I would move to the new system if that's the system at that restaurant.
Okay.
The European model is to put your, you know, the extra change, you know, a dollar or two that is left over from, round up, basically.
Right, mm-hmm. Don't put coins in your pocket.
Yeah, it's basically a courtesy. Yep. Here you go.
So at French cafes, for example, in Paris, there's a service charge is included, compris, is included in the account, but it's customary that when they bring your change, you get up and say bonjour and leave the change on the table. That's what you're referring to.
Yeah, and I think
a lot of people will still do that.
So before we say adieu to this, tipping, you say it's weird now, John, but gonna get okay, yeah, as we're used to it.
This is a transition period, and 5 or 10 years from now, it'll be absolutely natural.
Will it spread then outside of Seattle?
Well, I think it already
nationwide?
Is. It's already in New York,
yeah.
And that got a ton of attention nationally because it's New York, and right. No one really cared that we'd been doing it for a while here. But I think it's going to spread.
And yeah, I mean, I remember when we banned cigarette smoking in bars, and there was all this hullabaloo about how it was going to change the economics. Right? Nobody was going to go to bars anymore. Well, that has been the greatest thing that ever happened.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Pretty nice.
I think it'll spread too, partly because of the human nature and convenience, just as Erica said, that when the bill comes, the customer can say, okay, now this is all taken care of, right? And then they just pay what the bill is. That'll be a lot simpler.
It's kind of the Uber model, right? You don't tip your Uber driver.
But you could.
But you can't rate him.
I don't think you're allowed to.
Yeah,
don't they discourage
him.
That?
Yeah.
Okay, so there's, all right, restaurateurs, and I know they listen. Three out of three.
Hi, Tom.
What's that?
I said, hi, Tom.
Hi, Tom. Let tipping go. I'd love to know what you think. Facebook, KOW Public Radio. Paul Guppy, Erica C. Barnett, and John Rodgick back in a moment. So John Roderick snaps his fingers on the one.
That's a funky jam.
Not on the two, because it's funky jam.
Yeah.
Listening to David Bowie.
Yeah,
you know,
put it on the one.
A man wearing a dress was not cool to me when I was a kid on a military base in Omaha. But David Bowie was cool, and he didn't care what I thought, and he didn't care what my parents thought. He didn't care if I labeled him glam or new wave or Bing Crosby collaborator or straight or gay or Ziggy or thin white Duke. And following his death this week, I found I've been affected by David Bowie in a way that I don't think I'm going to be affected when Mick Jagger or Paul McCartney die, or maybe even Bob Dylan. I even feel a connection between David Bowie and Seattle. But I want to hear what you think, Seattle indie rocker John Roderick.
Well, the wonderful thing about David Bowie is he did care about what you thought about all those things. I mean, he was very, very conscious of
good point. He didn't seem to care, but right. Yes, go
conscious
on.
Of the power of his aesthetic. And yeah. What I loved about Bowie was that he adopted the persona of an alien, really, a UFO. But he did it in such a way that he seemed like he had emigrated here, and he was taking the side of humanity. So he was able to comment on our foibles from this outside perspective, right? He was from elsewhere, but he was ready to shed blood on our behalf, and he was a friend and an advocate for humanity. So that he had this very unique perspective, not just in music but culturally, where he could speak about us as a visitor, and I think that is somewhat how responsible for this feeling of his power that we all have.
Power, yeah. Let's turn to conservative. Straight-laced Paul Guppy.
That's right. Very.
You must have felt threatened by...
Confused.
You can't right? be threatened by a funky jam.
I don't know. I found it kind of affirming, actually.
Tell me.
I've always been a Bowie fan since I can remember. So Bowie, I liked him, his creativity, and he was constantly breaking out of his music styles and creating new ones, but also just for nostalgia that, you know, Let's Dance and Young American are like the club themes of the 1980s. I mean, yep. You couldn't go to a party or a club or dancing without hearing those everywhere. When I was in college, I lived in London for a while, and Bowie was number one everywhere.
Were you going to a lot of clubs, Paul?
Yes.
All right.
At that time. So, but my point is that I guess artistically, and I even noticed it.
You don't know the whole Paul Guppy story. Right. We're learning; it's unfolding right now, and he doesn't care whether you think he's glam or R&B.
I'm starting to see a new side of him.
That he was, and this is fairly obvious, I guess. But as someone who was listening at the time, is that he was breaking out of the kind of standard rock and roll of the 1970s and doing techno pop and things like that. He wouldn't be slotted into any kind of particular kind of music, and it was really creative and popular. Yeah.
For me, you know, I wasn't around for the 70s, but, you know, and I was very young in the 80s.
Humble brag.
I guess in this crowd it is. I didn't really think about that. But for me, I was very affected by his death, too. And I've been trying to sort of articulate to myself why, because I wasn't like a super fan.
Right. Me neither.
But it felt like I felt the same way you did, Bill. It just felt like the biggest deal in the world. And part of it was the way he died, the way that he orchestrated and his own death.
Yeah, let's talk about that.
And, you know, everything in his life was so performative, and everything he did was, you know, was for us in a weird way. And it felt like, you know, he performed his own death just perfectly. And there was something so moving about it. You know, I got a text that just said Bowie in all caps from a friend, and I was like, oh my God, what did he do now?
Yeah.
You know, what's his next, like, oh, Black Star just came out, and, you know, and this movie, or this Broadway play, and, you know, so what is it now? He's obviously announcing something, and this is what he was announcing.
Did you see his video, Lazarus?
I did, yeah.
Oh, it's harrowing.
Yeah, it's gripping. And so I was moved by that. And I think I was also, just when he was alive, I mean, just throughout his career, I've really been influenced or affected, whatever, by his gender performance and the fact that he is a man in a dress and he is Ziggy Stardust and he is all these sort of, you know, things that I didn't know you could be as, you know, a kid growing up in Mississippi and Texas.
Right.
And, you know, look, I'm a very, you know, heteronormative cis woman. So I've had a lot of advantages in life, but I do know that he was very meaningful to a lot of kids who are LGBTQ out in the country, you know, where they weren't on the coast, where they weren't being told they were okay. And he told them, you're not alone.
You know, I'm curious what you, I do feel a little hinky about even the positive judging of him around his death. And I wonder if anybody else feels this way at all, because it made me think of, you know, Jimmy Carter came out and announced that he has cancer, and David Bowie didn't. And Jimmy Carter got treatment at his age, chemotherapy. And some people, you know, I don't want to end my life that way. I'm going to do it this way. And some people he apparently kept it a secret, you know, and everybody does it a different way. And I feel a little uncomfortable when we talk about which way is the best and kind of who has dignity. And I know I'm not putting this on you, Eric. I'm just saying in general, did anybody else react to this kind of, like, it's such a private thing, and yet we feel comfortable saying David Bowie, you know, had these reasons and they're good reasons. So go on.
I'm not saying he had good reasons. I don't know what his reasons were, frankly. I just like the fact that he did it his own way instead of having it.
But who doesn't do it their own way? What does that mean?
Well, making a public announcement, while it is doing it your own way, is also saying, I feel an obligation to the world to do this thing. And I don't think that most people would like their deaths to be this massively public thing. Probably some do. But I like the fact, so maybe I am making a value judgment. I like the fact that he didn't seem to feel pressure to behave the way that most celebrities behave when they have cancer or are dying.
Yeah, I mean, the wonderful thing about Bowie was he was so other, but he was always accessible. I mean, he never removed himself from us, right? I mean, he was still making cameos and doing little things, and he never, the more you got to know him as a person, the more you respected him. And that's not always the case with celebrities.
But wasn't it wonderful, no offense, David Bowie, wasn't it wonderful marketing? We don't know David Bowie. You don't know David Bowie. And we also praise people who don't seem to need public attention. And so it just gets weird, even when it's love, even when it's praise, to me, it just feels weird when we're saying...
He made a gift of himself, too.
That's exactly what I was about to say.
Yeah, that's fair. I feel that, too.
Yeah, his whole life was sort of a gift to us, and I feel like the way he ended it was absolutely perfect and beautiful. And yeah, there's a kind of feeling when you go out and say, like, I'm dying, that you want to be present at your own funeral, right? That you want to reap those accolades on your way out. And he didn't. And that's noble, I think.
Good point. I appreciated the discretion and the privacy that he exercised. I was also impressed that he told some of his work colleagues, collaborators, and close friends, and they did not leak it, which I think indicates the strong relationship that he had.
But was Jimmy Carter indiscreet?
No, it was just a choice that President Carter made, knowing that he's a public person and that people would want to know. But I respect David Bowie because he did show that discretion. The other thing, you can never know a person's heart or their thoughts, but you know, when you're 69 and you're facing eternity in the face, I think you get at that moment when you know that death is coming and it's permanent. I think people become very reflective and mature and serious about how they want to, communicate that to the world. And I think he did it the right way.
I
think it was a relief that he avoided the tabloids and all of the scandal stuff and did it respectfully.
We're so out of time, so I don't have time to expound. But I just what I meant at the beginning about how I connect him to Seattle is that feeling that the thing an artist does to say it doesn't have to be this way. And maybe it's not even the way you think it is. I feel like there's a vibe of that in Seattle.
Absolutely. I mean, our music scene often looks back to Neil Young as a sort of godfather of the scene because of his sound and his attitude. But I think that Bowie is equally responsible for the kind of strange flamboyance that we've projected from here. And by strange, I don't mean ugly. I mean, you know, a proud unusualness.
It's the creativity of the music, where he created new waves of music that hadn't existed before.
And that's where we have to leave it, just because of the clock on the wall. I love that we talked about that and really spent the whole hour together. So thank you. John Roderick. I found that out. It's not Roderick.
No.
It's Roderick.
It's not Roderick.
No, it's not. Sorry. From the band The Long Winters, host of the podcast, Roderick on the line. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Roderick on the line.
Roderick on the line. Erica C. Barnett runs the blog, The C is for Crank. It's thecisforcrank.com.
Thank you.
Paul Guppy, Vice President for Research, Washington Policy Center. We're on Facebook, KOW Public Radio. I'm Bill Radke, and I'm so glad you've tuned in. Thank you all. We'll see you again next week.
Thanks
team.